Hello once again, I'm Stephen Davidson. You are listening to Our City Radio, and here we are with Looking Back, and I am honoured to have Stuart Goldsmith. A very warm welcome to you, Stuart.
Thanks very much.
On Our City Radio. You're here in Edinburgh once again. Is it okay to call you a fringe veteran?
Very much so, yes. I've been here many, many, many times.
How many is it, Stuart?
20.
20?
Oh, 20.
And does coming back, do you still enjoy it, or does it just feel like a job? Is it something that you have to do for your career?
It's not something that I have to do. I sort of can't imagine a world in which I don't come back here. And if I'm totally honest, I get giddy about it. I get excited in April and then giddy in July. And then when I get here, normally the first 2 days, I have some massive lurch and go, oh, Jesus, not this again. Yeah. And then I think of it as I pass through the membrane into the festival and then I go, oh, actually, it's great. This year, I got here and had 4 or 5 days of going, this is just brilliant, I'm so happy to be there. Yep. And on the fifth day, I suddenly went, oh God, I don't want to do this. That's the same thing. Bloody students everywhere, shows and all the venues are massive and it's all corporate branded advertising. I want to go home. But it was just the membrane. I just hadn't, I'd missed it and I just pushed it back further. As soon as I had that 24-hour period of going, oh, stuff this, I then came out the other side and went, this is definitely my best friends I've ever had.
Cool. And after a massive run of shows like that, just for people who don't do comedy at all, when you come to the end of it, do you miss that, performing every single day to the same crowd in the same city thing?
In a weird way, yes, because, I mean, there's the sort of nuts and bolts stuff. Like, I don't need to drive anywhere for an entire month. I normally do 15 to 20,000 miles a year in the name of comedy, or in the name of, you know, work, generally, of one sort or another. I certainly don't miss the driving while I'm here. Yeah. So there's that element of it. There's the sheer element of like going out and doing a show every night that I love. I was just talking to Mark Watson about this earlier on, about we're agreeing that this year we have shows in which there's no part of it where you think, oh God, I've got to get through this bit in order to get to that bit where I'm safe again.
Yeah.
Both of us, I think we feel that we've got shows where I just love doing every single bit of it. So I will miss doing it every night, but realistically, I will also lie down panting and go, oh my God, thank God that's over, I'm knackered. Yeah. You spend a week or two decompressing and then you go out and do a regular 20 minute set in a club and you go, good evening, oh God, that's 20 minutes up.
Yeah.
Because the whole thing's accelerated.
Yeah. And so your show this year is called Extra Life. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, certainly. It's all about how I'm desperate to have kids, but I think it's going to screw up my otherwise excellent life. So I've been very broody. I'm a broody man and have been as long as I can remember. I've always thought, God, I want to have kids. And I have, for one reason or another, never done it, never got round to it, never... I mean, I'm 37, you know, so it's not impossible by any means, but I'm slightly later than the sort of raft of people in the 31, 32. Yeah. Like, my younger brother's mates have started having babies, and I'm like, I've started panicking and going, no, I've got to have a kid. So the show is about that, but it's sort of accessible. You know, if you're in your 20s and you're not even thinking about childhood, it's all, parenthood rather, it's all just a bunch of, it's like my favourite jokes from the last 2 years. So it's jokes about my immortal granny, snipers, shopping, robots. It's just a huge load of beautiful rubbish. I love it a bit.
And Stuart, I was 37 when I had my first child, so this could be your year.
Is that right? Yeah, yes. Me and my girlfriend are talking about it, yes. Like most of my shows, I find writing it has helped me resolve something in my mind. People often go, oh, comedy shouldn't be therapy. But it is therapeutic.
Yeah.
I get my teeth into an issue, something I'm struggling with, whether I want to or not.
Yeah.
You know, normally I'm like, no, this time I'm just going to write jokes. And then 6 months later I go, all of these jokes appear to be about one thing that I'm wrestling with, you know. And like my previous shows, I feel like I've come out of this one going, yep, I've looked at all the options and I'm definitely going to do this.
Yeah, and you do. That was going to be my next question. You do have a girlfriend. That's a great start.
That is a good start, absolutely, yes. And I plan to knock her up. With her permission. She's expecting it.
Excellent. During the Fringe, possibly?
No. Well, do you know, you've got to time it, actually. During the Fringe would be arguably safe, but you've just got to make sure you don't have an August baby.
Right, okay.
Because you don't want to be having to fly down to wherever you live every year or having your child up here and you're always working on its birthday. Yeah. I think we've tried to be a bit canny about that. So in terms of the planning process, as much as one can plan these things, which I understand is not much, I would try very hard not to have an Edinburgh baby.
Right. Today's breaking news, Stuart Goldsmith, no Edinburgh baby. You also have your very successful ComCom podcast, which is a regular thing out with The Fringe, but you're doing the live version at the moment?
Yes, I am. Yes, ComCom is our shorthand for the Comedian's Comedian podcast, which is a show in which I interview comics about their writing process, their creative challenges in real depth. I think it is genuinely unique amongst podcasts and shows in that we really spend a long time getting into the nitty-gritty of how people write their stuff and how they cope with the various challenges of being a comic and being a creative person. And I did a big run of them last year at the festival. I did 26, 20, 25 of them. With people like Al Murray and Sarah Millican and like really some really big names, Ed Byrne and Rob Delaney. It's a free show, so hopefully some of these little bastard comedians will turn up who don't like paying for things. But we did the first one last night with Sam Simmons, and it was rammed. So I'm doing that at Bob and Misbehave's Bookshop on Holyrood Road, which is a beautiful, very free, fringy venue where you just walk on. You walk in, rather, from the street. It's right on the street. You walk in, wham, you're in the space. Couple of lights, couple of mics, little Tascam DR40 to record it on, and we just go for it. And we had so much fun last night. It was great. Cool. So I've got a few more of those coming up, and people can get tickets for those at heroesoffringe.com.
Right, so you have to reserve them first.
You can just turn up, but if you are worried that it's going to sell out, and it's only a sort of 60 capacity, well, 55 really, max. So if you're concerned that you're going to miss out, then you should jump on heroesoffringe.com, search for Google, you know, do an internal search for podcast, and then you can buy a ticket in advance for £5.
Right, and I've never been sure about that with the free fringe. Basically, these days they come out and they say, can we have the people with tickets first? And then they take the rest of the queue who are just queuing up. Is that right?
Yes, I believe so. It seems to be a great model because it's a free show. But if you're desperate to get in, you can get yourself a ticket. But it is still a free show. So if you're prepared to take a risk, then you can get in for free and pay what you want after, which might be nothing, or it might be £20, or it might be whatever you think the show is worth. I mean, I'm fascinated by the way that the Free Fringe has existed, developed, and gone in through these several different permutations now. Each Free Fringe appears to hate all the other Free Fringes. It's fascinating and dangerously political, and it's like being in kind of, you know, Renaissance France of people, you know, sort of accusing each other of things. But I'm astonished that I was a street performer for part of my career, and it's effectively street performing and podcasting as well, where I'm soliciting donations on the show. It's a free podcast and will always be free, but it follows the exact same model as a street performer that I did for some time, whereby you are giving someone a free thing and then asking them for money. And I'm astonished that the Edinburgh Festival and the world of podcasting have both taken on that model that I experienced as a street performer.
Right. You invented the whole thing, is that what you're saying?
Well, I certainly was part of the vanguard of it. I tell you what, between me and fellow comedian and street performer Pete Dobbing, I honestly think this is true, we have certainly contributed to a revolution in how people ask for money. Because as street performers, we know the rules. And if we talk to Free Fringe, basically, if you're a Free Fringe performer, come and ask me what the rules are, because I can probably double or triple what you're making.
Nice. And would you charge for that, Stu?
I don't charge for that, but I only tell people I like.
Okay. That's good. So ask Stuart Goldsmith for the advice on how to make money from street performing. If he tells you he likes you, if he doesn't like you. Simple as that.
It's a pretty easy barometer. Yep.
Stu, the show's called Looking Back. So we're gonna go into the bulk of the show, which is looking back over your life in a minute. But first of all, can you give me just a potted history, maybe just a minute's worth of how you came to be a stand-up comedian? Just a brief snapshot.
A brief snapshot would be, I used to be a street performer. I had various circus skills, and I did a street show where I did a bunch of circus skills and a bunch of chat and making people laugh. And I discovered I had an aptitude for making people laugh and really enjoyed it, and just sort of felt confident and happy in a way that I probably didn't feel in the rest of my life. And then gradually the show contained less and less circus and more being funny, until I went, oh, come off it, Goldsmith, you're a comedian. And then I did my first ever gig, and I was rubbish. And I remember looking, I was so nervous, I looked down, I saw my hand shaking in front of me, and it was kind of rubbish, but I came off going, oh, I found my thing.
Yeah. And how rubbish was it? Was it no laughs rubbish?
Or
was
no, it wasn't no laughs. Worked? I mean, yeah. I'd done street shows for long enough that I felt comfortable improvising in front of an audience. So the rubbish that I'd written, I think my first joke was about sex and death. In fact, I've not thought about this in years. This is like 10 or 11 years ago. It was, I was going, yes, it's weird life, isn't it? Sex, 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 death. It's different for mayflies, isn't it? Sex, death. It's different for vampires, isn't it? Death, sex. And I, you know, it's not a bad premise. I could revisit it now that I'm funny. I could maybe make it work. But at the time, I was cheerfully rubbish.
Cool. And so when was the first? When did you first storm it? Then, you know, as comedians would say, when was the first gig you stood up there and your whole five or your whole 10 big laughs, and you thought,
God, I don't have a very good memory for stuff like that. I mean, obviously, I remember some gigs. Obviously, you remember the deaths better than you remember the storming it. And I think as well, and this is going to be a very pompous podcasty thing to say, but, you know, have I ever stormed it? I mean, I've seen people storm it harder than I have ever stormed it. So I can certainly say, on a scale of my best gigs, which ones my best ones were. But then if you see them in comparison to someone like Phil Kay do something completely improvised and take the roof off, you go, yeah, my idea of storming it isn't really storming it, is it? Yeah. Like, by those standards, I've done quite well. I suppose there will have been early gigs where I used to do a thing about the first bit that I went, oh, this is my first closer. I've got a closing bit now. And that was a comparison of the sign language for the male and female orgasms. And that just started doing really well in any room. And that was a very good feeling. And that later was called Undemanding by Chortle. And no, that was a very good point, because all I wanted to do was make people laugh. And that is not a very demanding thing in the eyes of...
But you're a comedian, so it's a good thing.
It's a good thing, but it's also... You know, the more I learn about it, the more you realise, yes, I did make people laugh, but... God, there is more out there than that, than that ambition, and whatever thing you wanted. Like, you can do anything. It's like, okay, you're going to be a painter. What do you want to do? Do you want to paint a picture of someone's face? Okay, fine. But do you want to do a photorealistic one, or do you want to do an abstract one? There's everything there for you. Do you want to paint a picture of someone's face by filling shoes full of milk? You can do anything. You know what I mean? And so maybe I had narrower horizons than I realized at the time.
Okay, Stuart, that's a lovely snapshot of what you've done so far. We are going to go right back now after, you're going to hear a record now on Our City Radio, but after that we'll be going backwards in time with Stuart Goldsmith.
And I'm scared of too much in my life. Little hurricanes blow through my mind. Like a thought off the course. Flows to my dreams, psychic kerosene fuels the fire, burning hard. My desire for the comeback, I can't give you time to choose this side. What it is you're doing, you're a fibber, won't deliver anything you say.
With us today on Looking Back is Stuart Goldsmith, a comedian and broadcaster extraordinaire who began telling jokes on stage at 25 years old. But we're not looking at that part of your life, Stuart. With your permission, I would like to look back way beyond your first thoughts of doing stand-up to the story of your life, to the life that led you to take that first step onto the stand-up stage.
Yes.
I want to see the recipe. I want to see the ingredients. I want to see the oven that created the comedian that is Stuart Goldsmith.
Sure.
So, Stuart Goldsmith, are you willing to open the door to your journey?
Yes, I will open the door to my oven. I will let you all climb inside
Excellent. I'd like to start off with just a quick mention of your family name, because of the huge influence that your family have had on your life. And the name itself, you were born Stuart Heathcliff Goldfinger.
That's
and
right.
It's jumping ahead before we look back again. But when you decided to do stand-up, did you just decide the family name was too funny?
Well, it was more that I just didn't want, as you can imagine, growing up with a surname Goldfinger, I don't want to say I suffered from bullying, because it's certainly not a sob story, but, you know, I was at school at a time when Goldfinger was, you know, Orrick Goldfinger, who was, you know, he was a bad guy. Yeah. And I liked it. I mean, there was a kid in my school called James Campion Bond, right. And he got the shit kicked out of him. Uh-huh. And so I was responsible for a lot of that. I started a lot of that almost as a smokescreen, whereby I would employ bullies, sort of hench boys, if you will, to go and start stuff with him in order that no one really think twice about my own surname. Now, what ended up happening there, of course, was that after a while, he managed to persuade everyone that he was the good guy and managed to turn that tide of violence and, I mean, not just violence, name-calling as well, managed to turn it against me. So in the end, by the time I sort of entered secondary school, I was already starting to think that this what for my family is a very proud tradition of bankers and magicians, that's formed up, as you know, the name Goldfinger comes from the Goldman family and the Fingersmith family.
Of course.
As far ago as, I mean, what, sort of stretches back 300 years through English and Italian history. What was a very proud name for us was, in fact, being perverted by the legacy of these stupid films.
Yeah. That's fascinating stuff.
I just didn't want that to happen again. You know, by going on the comedy circuit, I thought, I'm opening a door here to having my family name dragged through the mud.
Yeah,
and have people try to electrocute me by pressing me against bars in Fort Knox.
Yeah, I completely understand. So let's take then Stuart Heathcliff Goldfinger, as you were then, right back to the start. You're born into a loving family, and yet within 2 months of your life beginning, your parents have sent you to army cadet training, which is normally for 15 to 17-year-olds.
Yes.
You remain there for 3 years, until you're 3 years old, when you're allowed back home for Christmas.
Yes.
Do you have any memories, any clear memories of that time?
Well, listen, I have nothing but positive memories of that time. I mean, they are, you know, they're as hazy as any childhood memories will be. But I will always be proud that I was the youngest army cadet in the country. And I managed to attain the rank of general at the age of 2.5. Now, not everybody can say that. And it's just as well, because if you think about the state the British Army would be in, if all the generals are 2.5, it's preposterous. But, you know, be sending, you know, rusks to die in foreign fields. No one wants that. But I will always be proud of it. And I do have some very happy memories of Tam, who was my gunnery sergeant major, who I think had a bit of a soft spot for me, because when the other cadets were being force marched up and down hills, he was only too happy to sit me in a little sort of camouflage papoose on the front of his chest. Everything in my life really derives as a result of Tam's treatment of me, because without that experience of command, I'd never have entered the parachute regiment when I was 5. Right. And I don't know. It's never been something I've been ashamed of. I don't talk about it because it's so, you know, I know a lot of people have a lot of issues with the army and so forth. But I will never forget the experience of riding in a specially constructed papoose on the front of a lunatic of a sergeant major. Huge Scotsman he was, with tattoos on his eyes. And as he jutted out the top of a Sherman tank, and we went into what started off as a training exercise, but quickly became a real battle.
In Britain?
In Britain, absolutely, yes.
Who against?
Well, the British, other British people. Oh, it was sort of an inter... Well, I mean, a lot of it was hushed up, but ultimately it was, I mean, it was Geordies v Cockneys, and, you know, may the best men win, and they did.
And Tam, your friendship with Tam, that was going to be my next question there, because, I mean, most of the other cadets are 15 to 17.
Yes.
You know, and you're between the ages of 2 months and 3, and by 2.5 you're a general as well. That's going to make it. The other cadets aren't going to be able to, you know, if you've gone that fast.
Listen, they were jealous. They were jealous. But fortunately, due to my rank, there was nothing they could do. So every so often I'd turn around, I'd see one looking daggers at me. And, you know, by that time I had the rank to just, you know, send him off on manoeuvres. I mean, a couple of them I had to ensure they were never seen again.
And the way you talk about it, Stuart, it's obvious that you loved the army life.
I loved it.
And as much as, but you get to 5 years old And at that point, as you say, you enter the parachute regiment, and then your parents yank you out of the parachute regiment, having decided that sport rather than war is your future. I mean, that
I know that basically I saw
the film of your life, and I know that Hollywood's all about, it's all about drama, it's all about entertainment.
The
film of your life.
Suddenly everyone's an American. Absolutely.
The film of your life has your dad, American, and unless we forget, a 6 times world darts champion, making you play darts for 6 hours every day. I mean, that can't be the real truth.
I'll be honest, it's worse than that. It was more like 16 hours a day. My dad, honestly, he made the patriarch of the Jackson family, he made him look like SpongeBob SquarePants. I mean, he was a monster, my father. And I don't know what sort of man would drag a child, a five-year-old child, out of the parachute regiment where he's worked so hard to make a name for himself. I mean, this is after I was busted back down to private between the ages of 4 and 4.5. So I joined the parachute regiment as a means of trying to claw back some of that respect, which I'd enjoyed as a younger boy. And I was on the verge of making it during a mission over Sicily, which, of course, is sort of black ops. I can't talk about it now. But it was to do with the mafia, and there was an awful lot of, the sort of early triad were getting involved. And we were on the verge of success. We were on the verge of smashing the mafia. And all of a sudden, I've got to go and play darts for 16 hours a day. Now, as you can imagine, I mean, God knows how anyone plays darts for 6 minutes. I find the game thoroughly boring. As soon as I'm 16 hours a day training, obviously within a month, I was world-class status, standard. And just throwing, just bullseye after bullseye after bullseye. And that man was never happy. And in many ways, that's where a lot of my comedy comes from, is just desperately wanting this bastard to stop making me play darts.
Yeah, and yet you kind of saved yourself from that life.
Well, I did.
By being, there was a 2 month, I don't know, Stuart, whether this is a lack of skill, or the way you talk there, it makes me think that you'd already become brilliant at darts, but there's a 3 month period in your life when not even one arrow hits the board. And then your mum pulls you out of this intensive world.
This is why the movie is never as interesting as the real story, and we know this. Not only were none of my family in the circus, as that film suggested, I don't know why they just sort of threw that in. My sister was never a stripper. My brother was never a series of microbes on a petri dish. Yeah. I don't know why they'd even put those. Like, there's enough to the story, you know what I mean? But those 3 months, it was two to three months, where I supposedly couldn't hit the target. That entire time, I was experimenting with throwing the. I was so good at darts that I was experimenting with unbelievable curveball shots. Have you ever seen the film Bulletproof Monk?
Yep.
Yeah. So you know this is a monk. He's able to. You fire a gun at him, and he's able to launch himself at you in such a way that he travels around the path of the bullet and he's untouchable.
Yeah.
I was trying to do something similar. That's actually what that film was based on. Was my experiments in the field of darts, trying to get a perfect score at darts whilst throwing in a completely different direction, which was randomly determined through throwing a series of D6.
But your mum...
Sorry, which is a gaming term. You might have six-sided dice.
But your mum just thinks you've got a bit rubbish during
exactly, exactly. Yeah. And, and to be honest, for the first time, I was interested in darts again. I was passionate about darts. Yeah. And I just felt such a lack of support from either of my parents, from this tyrant of a father, or my mother who... might as well have been, I don't know. I mean, she was like a living sarcophagus of a woman.
Yeah.
Just dusty, cavernous, and phenomenally dangerous.
Yeah. Well, I read your...
Cursed, if anything.
I read your mum comes across, she comes across kind of badly and well at the same time in your autobiography.
Well, she had tremendous archaeological value.
I see that. I mean, I want to say this right up, Stuart. I read your autobiography cover to cover, and I loved it.
Thank you. Absolutely
loved it.
Thank you. My ghostwriter put a lot of work into that, and I really appreciate it.
People should go out and buy it. But to digress slightly, the title of your book, Boomerangs and Bicycles, I didn't get it. I didn't see any reference to boomerangs or bicycles in the text. Are you willing to say what it means?
What is this? You didn't get it. You didn't understand...
No.
I mean, what is the journey? What is the story of my life, if not an endless cycle of a sort of Aboriginal martial arts instrument repeating on itself over and over again in a completely ecologically sustainable way? Boomerangs and bicycles. I mean, for God's sake.
Sorry, when you say it like that, it's so obvious.
Well, you say you read it cover to cover, but it's so easy to read the text without reading any of the subtext. And frankly, you're not the first person to say this to me. And if any of your listeners fancy coming up to me and asking me to repeat that, I'll be more than happy to give them a smack in the mouth.
Yeah, you're absolutely right to do that as well. And I hope that I'll get a smack in the mouth at the end for even asking that.
But I will give you a thorough seeing to.
Not yet, though, because... But back to the... I mean, I've mentioned the book, but I must mention chapter 3. I mean, chapter 3 is just blank pages. And I assume that covers your primary school years. But I read each page.
Yes.
I found it puzzling and yet uplifting at the same time.
Thank you.
Why are the pages blank?
Well, I just wanted to give people a bit of a break. I mean, the first two chapters are, I think you'll agree, I think we can all agree, as Zadie Smith described them, the finest and most kinetic chapters in modern literature. The story of the darts, the story of becoming the general, the papoose.
Yeah.
Chapter 2, Hell in a Handcart, where I'm obviously, you know, the difficult years in which people think the darts success has gone to my head and I'm some sort of lunatic, where actually I'm pioneering a whole new approach to the sport that ended in that horrible fire at the Commonwealth Games. I just thought it'd be good for people to have a bit of a rest. And as luck would have it, that moment fitted perfectly with the amnesia that happened as a result of what I shall only refer to as the incident.
Right. So basically, that chapter is basically go and have a lie down or keep reading. Have a rest.
Keep reading, have a rest whilst you're reading. And then I snap back, as you know, in chapter 4, in the remnants of this ruined castle covered in human excrement, and just wondering what the hell is going to happen next.
Yeah, and I think chapter 4 is maybe my favourite chapter in the book, but the first 5 pages of chapter 4, one word on each page, what's the time, Mr. Wolf?
Yes.
Why does the chapter start? Because it starts like that, and then it goes into the remnants of the castle. Is it a hidden mess? I'm obviously
working on a slightly different level to you. Let me ask you now, look me in the eye and tell me, what is the time, Mr. Wolf?
Is it nighttime?
It is nighttime.
I thought that, and I thought I'm going to say that, and he's going to smash me down like he did.
I'm certainly still going to smash you down, but you've come some way towards clawing your way back there.
Good.
Yes, it is. What's the time, Mr. Wolf? I've always been obsessed with riddles. You can tell that from the unique Möbius strip loop structure of chapters 9 through 13. And which is, you know, they sort of fold back in on themselves. And if anyone ever manages, and I would be interested, this is the question I really want people to ask me when they stop me in the street, as people do constantly. And I mean, I say this now, and you can see that we're looking out the window. We're absolutely besieged with these Muppets. But the question I'd really like them to ask me, or the comment that I'd really like to hear, is for someone to have cracked the code of chapters 9 to 13. And thus far, no one has. The Fabergé egg remains untouched, undiscovered. And only I know the location. So,
and yet, some people should be able to join the dots between the film and the puzzle that is those chapters. And I'd like to maybe
well, listen, I'm not going to give anything away on that front because, you know, not a day goes past without someone sending me a YouTube video of them spooling the reel out of the original film canister, holding it to the light, waiting for the sun to come up at 12:07 or whatever it is, and, you know, hoping it's going to go through the holes that they cut by cutting out the circles in the O's in chapter 9.
Yeah.
And as if that's going to reveal to them on, you know, reflected in a mirror over Google. I've said too much.
Let's talk about what we do know about that period in your life. You finished primary school, and then we go through the period of your life that you described to David Letterman as a short, sharp shock.
Yes.
Years of 12 to 16, Sean Penn and Madonna try and adopt you, and you run away from home.
Yes.
Tell me more.
Well, I mean, what more is there to tell? It's not my place to talk about the private business of Sean Penn and Madonna. I mean, everyone knows what loathsome people they are. Everyone knows. I mean, certainly it's an open secret in Hollywood circles that this adoption frenzy they seem to have started is little more than a front for manufacture of sneakers. Trainers, yeah. What we would call trainers. And as a result, I looked at it. Someone with my military experience, someone with my pioneering spirit is not going to be content to sit and stitch trainers together for the brand Nike.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how many times you vogue at me, mother, I'm not doing it. I'm walking away. And I think what gave me the strength to do that was my mother, the sarcophagus, because it's so much easier to look at Madonna, someone with all that celebrity, all that fame, for whom a lesser man would be quite cowed. It's so much easier to look at them and just think to yourself, you know, at least they're not an ancient Egyptian tomb from several thousand years ago snapping its lid at you. Yeah, which, I mean, I recognise in many ways Madonna is, but because I'd been through that experience before, I was able just to sneak away. And I did sneak. I didn't fight my way out. And those reports were just nonsense. I had no need to stab my way out. I simply climbed out the window, shinned down a drainpipe, and there I was, popped on a Segway. I was out of there.
Yeah, and after that, for a while, as your very good friend Michael Douglas is quoted as saying, you're a shit without...
Michael.
You're a shit without... He says,
what a shit. No, go on. Go on. What's he said?
He says you were a shit without a sail. And we'll get to the reason later on why you describe him like that. But he said that you were a shit without a sail. And I'd like, rather than even discussing this actual phrase, I'd like to at this point bring in Ocean to Burn's epic song, Hollow Bones, comes into your life.
Mm.
And we're going to play it. But
oh my God, you've tracked it down.
I have. But what does it mean to you? We're going to play it straight after your explanation of what it
sure.
means.
Sure. Well, listen, it's apt that you'd mentioned that, the connection with Michael Douglas. Dear Michael, I mean, if I'm a ship without a sail, good God, he's a submarine without an engine. But I think what really strikes me about this song, and what's always struck me, is the way it's possible, when you're listening to it, to close your eyes and actually taste the song in your mouth. And to me, it's salted caramel. It's regret, and it's just that noise. Just that. I can taste that noise in my mouth.
And this is Hollow Bones, Ocean to Burn on Our City Radio. This is Looking Back on Our City Radio. That was Hollow Bones, Ocean to Burn, played in honour of our guest today, Stuart Goldfinger, as he was then. Stuart Goldsmith, as he is now. But yes. Basically, then, we're talking about Stuart Goldfinger. Stuart Goldfinger hits 18, he returns home, and we have the Richard Branson-esque success story that is Shoes the Chemist.
Yes.
Your dad's garden hut backs onto the road. You've told the story many, many times. But
yes.
Your dad's garden hut backs onto the road. You smash out a couple of wooden panels and you start selling your grand's stolen Kirby grips and perfume made from rose petals to passers-by. I mean, what do you remember from this time of your life?
Well, you know, people say, was I a fence? And I don't like the word fence. Fence, to me, suggests something that the police need to get involved with. And the point of that whole operation was that it was borderline illegal, and that's an important word, borderline. That's why I chose the name Shoes the Chemist, because the whole idea is, you know, we everyone knows Boots the Chemist. You see Shoes the Chemist, you think to yourself, you know, I mean, obviously we had a couple of people wandering in asking if we were shoe zone idiots. What we wanted to bring to the public was a sort of discount service whereby they could cheaply avail themselves of other people's stuff. We're not just saying here's a lipstick, we're saying here's a lipstick that you can be pretty certain has been stolen, but you needn't trouble your conscience because some of it is legit. So it's not just a lipstick, it's the thrill of a potentially purloined lipstick. And as a result, I mean, obviously it backfired. Once we'd made our millions, obviously, you know, the cat was out of the bag and everyone started shoplifting us and then donating the stuff back to the original owners. But, you know, let them. They enjoyed themselves.
It's obviously a joyous time financially, because within 4 years, there are 16 branches of Shoes of the Chemist
rolling
on the nation's high streets.
We were rolling in it.
Your main rivals must... They've been going for 160 years. You know, it must have been a huge challenge going up against them, particularly when they're legit.
There was barely a day went past that we didn't drive a big truck full of our money in front of Boots the Chemist, the head office, and burn it in front of them, running around it, laughing, hooting like apes. I mean, it was an extraordinary time. And, you know, I'm just disappointed it ended so tragically with the death of all those orphans in the sort of money pit.
Yeah, I think...
I mean, they were orphans. Who's going to cry for them? But at the same time, it did give me cause to pause.
Do you think the stolen stuff going back, being shoplifted and taken back to the shops is what broke you? Or do you think the fact that you remained, even after 4 years, mainly selling Kirby grips and rose petal perfume, did that work against you?
Well, listen, if we're talking about what broke me. I've never been broken. I've always bended. That's always been the Goldfinger way. We bend at the knuckle. And if we don't bend at the first knuckle, we bend at the second knuckle. And after that, we melt. So I reject completely the implication that it broke me. But I just discovered a bit of a knack for selling. You know, you could sell water to a whale or, you know, fridges to Inuits. I could sell Kirby grips to a bald man. And I've always been very proud of that.
But I'm going to pick you up on this, Stuart, but you've pointed to the orphan death as what really finished Shoes the Chemist. But as it was reported in most of the newspapers, things started to unravel when people discovered that under each shop there was a dungeon, which you were hiring out to politicians and barristers for huge amounts of money. Did you realise that people would get so angry?
I honestly... Look, and I've not really spoken about this element of it before, but the whole thing with the orphan fire was a smokescreen, a literal and metaphorical smokescreen, which I deliberately started.
So no in order to died.
No, they died, but they died deliberately. I killed them in an attempt to distract attention from the whole dungeon scenario. Because what people choose to do in the privacy of their own or my dungeon is entirely their own business. And, you know, if a couple of orphans need to get toasted in order to help them get away with their own private business, then so much the better. And I was just sickened that it backfired so horribly. And as a result, all of this news came out about the dungeons. It basically, every time I saw a newspaper headline about, you know, Goldsmith's dungeons, Goldfinger's dungeons, you know, all of that nonsense, I just thought, well, thanks to you now, Mr. Journalist, these orphans have died in vain. Yeah. Made me sick to my stomach.
Yeah, I mean, there's no blame to lie at your door at all.
Well, I mean, I certainly killed them, but you know, it's sort of tit for tat, isn't it?
Yeah. It's heartbreaking for me to go through this step by step, because I see, again, at this point in your life, you're back at square one again. You know, that's where Stuart Goldsmith always ends up. You know, you narrowly escape jail, you're back at square one, and then you'll... I can see you smiling already at this.
Yes,
go on. At this point in your life, when you receive the famous call from Michael Flatley, where he says, Right, Stuart, one word, can you dance?
I know.
Can you remember picking up the phone?
I know. That whole time was such a blur. Picking up the phone is almost the last thing I remember from that time. I felt like as soon as he asked me, can you dance, I knew exactly what he meant. It did occur to me, I was so kind of frustrated at being back to square one yet again. And obviously that motivates me, it fires me, it drives me. But at the same time, it's just after industry, empire after empire, and ashes in my mouth. Part of me felt a sort of an almost perverse thrill. You know when you're at the edge of a cliff and you nearly throw yourself off? Part of me felt like telling him no. Do you know what? I can't.
Yeah.
I've got 3 left feet. But it flashed into my mind. I thought, Goldfinger, get a hold of yourself. Tell the bloody truth. I said flatly, I can dance you into an early grave. And we were off. The next 3 years is, I mean, to call it a blur is an insult to blurs. The next 3 years was like the superhero The Flash dancing his way through an orgy of gigs, really some very, very misguided sexual encounters, and an awful lot of alcohol.
And yet, it sounds, again, you just, it's glory, 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 and then you stumble on the path to greatness again.
Yes.
Despite you become the lead dancer.
Yes.
And then...
Yes. Well, it was just rotten luck that I was the lead dancer at a time when the lead choreographer was the brother of one of the orphans that I'd murdered. And I don't think he... The funny thing is, to this day, I don't know whether he knew or whether he just had it in for anyone that that hadn't been maimed in a fire.
It's a bit of a theme. It's a theme running through the show, Stuart, is that you're pointing to reasons for things happening when I've heard a very different version of events in the newspapers and from people I've spoken to in the cast who worked with you at that time.
Sure.
They put it down to the fact that you released a single called I Am The Best, Don't Watch The Rest, which includes the lyric, I am own 2 sparkling feet, they shuffle their plates of meat. I mean, did it occur to you that that would upset the rest of the cast?
I wanted to upset the rest of the cast. Why would I launch into, as a matter of record, anyone can download the song on iTunes, I still get 4 pence for every copy, but why would I launch into such a savage attack, and you know how temperamental dancers are, without it being part of a deliberate campaign to overthrow Flatley's gang of dweebs from the inside? So, yes, absolutely, I did it. I'll do it again. That wasn't the only thing I did. I was doing apple pie beds. I was putting cling film over toilets backstage. I was swapping people's arnica for deep heat. I was swapping people's deep heat for toothpaste. And it just became such a war of attrition whereby I thought, this, I've got to take these bastards to the cleaners. And, I think I proved my point. The record went straight to number 3. And we never made the top 2, which it will always annoy me, but we held on at 3 for, you know, it was Bryan Adams was at number 1, and, you know, no one could topple him.
Yeah.
I forget number 2, something about an astronaut. And we held on to number 3. We clung in there. Can we topple Adams? Can we topple Adams? And we couldn't. But by the time I started to slip back down the charts, my work was done. Flatley's career was in tatters, and the dancers were running around clutching their eyes, knees and teeth.
And you mentioned the number 3 there, which has played a huge part in your entire life. And I'm going to bring us back to Michael Douglas again.
Sure.
Because somehow,
oh, yeah, of course, yeah,
despite having shot yourself in those dancing feet, you again, you come out smelling of roses, rose petal roses, and you're offered a plum role in Basic Instinct 3. I mean, did you have any second thoughts on taking the role, given that you were replacing your friend Michael Douglas?
Yes.
In the starring role, and that he was no longer part of the
franchise? I knew we'd fall out. As soon as the script landed on my altar, I shook it out of its little envelope and I looked at it and I thought, it's like that moment when, you know, a pretty girl walks into the room on the arm of your best friend and you think, well, friendship's over, I'm going to marry that girl. With me, I'm going to marry that script. I'm going to marry it. And I did at the time. I got my agent to perform a small ceremony as soon as I'd finished the initial read-through. And I cut the very bottom of the script off once I'd wound it into a tight roll and used that as a ring, which I then wore on 2 of my fingers, quite big, for the whole of the process. I knew it would piss Douglas off, and I wasn't wrong. You know, he'd said to me in confidence he was ready to leave the franchise. I knew he wasn't.
Yeah.
And I just ended up thinking, you know, fuck him.
Yeah, I can see that. How could... That's very, very harsh. When I, for everything...
Listen,
he still speaks very fondly of you. That's why it seems so harsh to me.
Well, I'm an incredibly nice man. And orphans notwithstanding, I've never done any harm to anyone. Well, orphans, cast of Riverdance, Douglas himself. Oh, God, I suppose... Yes, well, I suppose now I sort of see it all in context. I mean, I'm...
A villain.
I am a villain. I am Goldfinger.
Talking of villains, though, Stu, let's pop him back to the film just for a second. I mean, it didn't mean anything to anyone at the time, but of course now. I mean, how was it acting with a young Nick Clegg?
Well, I mean, you know, I'll say this for Cleggy. In his early days, he had a lot more vim and vigour than anyone sees him now. I never see Nick anymore, and obviously his press is that he's this awful sort of limp, oath-breaking glass of water. When he was a younger man and as an actor, he was vigorous. My God, he could drink. He drank me under the table on several occasions. He would arm wrestle at the drop of a hat. He would snort lines of cocaine mixed with gunpowder, which he called bang bang. Mm. And he was a monster. I couldn't keep up with him. And I don't know what it was that turned him from that animal, that sort of, I mean, God, he out Hemingway. I don't know what turned him into the lanky streak of piss that we see now, you know, sort of Cameron's lapdog. Don't know what happened. I can only assume some sort of hypnosis or some implanted post-hypnotic suggestion. I've no idea.
So you'd be saying to Clegg, get out of politics and audition again.
Get out of politics. Get back on the acting set. Get yourself back into spotlight. Chin a few casting directors. Tattoo yourself a few more times. And just get back on the horse. Politics is over for you now, Cleggy.
Well, inevitably, the film flops, you know. It flops for Clegg, it flops for you. And you develop an addiction to rum. And at one night, I wish I had a violin to play under all this, Stew, but one night you fall asleep in the gutter of Hollywood Boulevard. But during that night, something magical happens, isn't it? Someone takes pity on you. They see you lying in the gutter during the night, and they put three apples under your head as a pillow. I mean, What happens when you wake up? What happens?
Well, listen, I mean, we all know the story. I woke up. I saw that I had no money for a bus. I had no money for food. I considered eating the apples just as I was about to take a bite of the first one. I thought, Goldfinger, this is another new start. I took one in my right hand. I took two in my left. I threw the one in my right hand. I realised I'd got it wrong.
Yeah.
And only 3 days later, I could do a passable cascade. I was a juggler. It was a new start. But you know what? That's the story everyone knows. What not everyone knows is that I wasn't asleep at the time. I was in a fug.
Yeah.
I wasn't totally unconscious.
Yeah.
And I know who left the apples. Oh. And it was Madonna.
Oh,
and
that is amazing.
I think in some way, her forgiveness was as important to me as the fruit itself.
And so begins your golden path that leads you directly to the stand-up comedy stage. You know, it's an amazing life, Stu. And we're just going to wrap up now. I've loved speaking to you. We're going to finish with our traditional, you may have heard this before in the show, it's our traditional standby or catch a ship section.
Oh, yes, lovely. Go on.
So short, sharp quotes from yourself at different points in your life, and you either stand by them or you distance yourself from them.
Understood.
So I'm looking for standby or catch a ship.
Okay.
Number one, I am Europe's top entertainer.
Stand by that.
Number two, people who go to 10-pin bowling should be shot.
Stand by that. And I'm quite insulted that you'd even ask that one. I mean, come on.
Number three, all the world's a stage, but sometimes I wish I was still selling Kirby Grips.
Do you know what? I would catch a ship on that one, because now to me, what I say now and what I actually have tattooed across my back is, if I just move my, you see that?
Yep.
All the world's a stage, but some of us are in the gutter.
Did you write that?
Yes.
That is amazing. It sounds familiar, but that's amazing.
Thank you. It's a mashup.
And number four, sometimes after I eat porridge, I can levitate.
Well, listen, I stand by that because it was meant in fun. So right. I stand by the spirit in which that was made. I actually, what I meant to say was, after I ate porridge, sometimes I regurgitate the porridge. It Fair came enough. Out wrong. I just stuck with it. And, you know, hence Dynamo. The less said about that, the better.
Fair enough. Stuart, it's been an immense pleasure speaking to you. And we finished by playing your funeral. So it sounds a bit downbeat, but I like that we've looked back.
No. For like me, like a funeral, celebration.
Why have you chosen Heavy Duck's Oriental Building? Why have you chosen that song to play as your relatives weep?
Do you know, I've played it because I want them to weep. And there's something about the chords in this song. There's something about the chord progression. And I'm not a musician by any means. But there's something about it that just reduces grown men to jelly. And whilst I want the funeral, the event itself, to be a celebration of my life, by God, during this song, let's have a right old bit of catharsis. Let's get the grannies crying. Let's do it.
Stuart, thank you for looking back. And I wish you the very best of luck going forward.
My pleasure.
All the places we have gone, reliving it, replacing memories that feel so sore. My feelings run with them. I have to chase them to go on. I have to bury them. Replace these memories.